Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here to speak to Reen and his wife and his colleagues. Reen Van Genuchten first got involved with the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission when we had the Evans conferences back in the 80s. And then in 1989, we sponsored his workshop in Riverside. And then again in 1997, he and Jurgis Simonek came to our headquarters building in Rockville and gave two wonderful courses, the first one on Ansota, Rosetta, and Hydrus, and then 3 years later on Hydrus 2D and Freak C. And more recently, Reen was a member of our work group on uncertainty and parameter estimation. This morning, Ty brought up the issue of how can soil scientists become more involved. There are 10 federal agencies right now involved in environmental modeling. ARS is one of the 10, and Yakov Pachevsky is the person on that committee now. I can't begin to say enough good things about Reen because of his helpful nature. We had a website that he saw to it that was extremely good. We had a problem because of some of the national labs were competing, and he said, we can do it, and he did do it. And I'm always impressed that when he says he can do something, he follows through. And I think for a lot of federal employees, that's one of the most important lessons is follow through. Well, today I'm going to talk about something relatively new. It's on mobility of radionuclides in the smear zone. And my co-author is Mark Furman, a geochemist. He was originally with Brookhaven, now he's with us. Okay. The outline of the talk is I'll simply tell you, if you don't know already, what the smear zone is, how radionuclides are mobile in it, how the smear zone may influence the mobility of radionuclides, the uncertainties of the what is bioremediation, because that's the particular remediation we're worried about. That's why we're worrying about mobility of radionuclides in the smear zone. The monitoring of performance indicators determine the efficacy of in-situ bioremediation, and then what kinds of research we're doing right now to support that work. And then for those who are interested, there's some information sources. Well, first of all, what is the smear zone? The smear zone is that zone between the regional water table and fluctuations. This is an example at the Hanford 300 area, where in the past they had radionuclides in trenches, and they removed most of the material, but since then the radionuclides, primarily uranium but other ones, have migrated down through the unsaturated zone. And it is now being affected by daily fluctuations of the water table due to the Columbia River, which is a regulated river. And then it moves to the groundwater and moves to the Columbia River. And there's a series of seeps and springs along the Columbia River, which are being analyzed. So it's this smear zone that we want to put our attention. Remediation is thought to be effective for long periods of time. First, we had licensed facilities that chose monitor natural attenuation. Unfortunately, that isn't working, so it was proposed by a licensee and their contractor to use in-situ bioremediation. We're investigating how stable that is and whether it's effective over long time periods. Well, first of all, what causes radionuclides to move? We've already heard from Fred Maltz and others about plutonium and other types of transport. Obviously, solubility is important. With regard to uranium is the focus right now, but all radionuclides, the question is it going to precipitate out as an individual mineral, or is it going to more commonly co-precipitate with other minerals, especially calcium carbonate? We've heard about redox chemistry. The four radionuclides we're most concerned about that are very sensitive to redox chemistry is uranium, technetium, iodine, and neptunium. We've heard about adsorption and desorption. Microbial activity, this is a new factor for us. We certainly could use the help of soil scientists to understand microbial activity, and that's one of the catalyst, the agent to cause the sequestering, in this case of uranium. Radioactive decay obviously is going to cause the threat, the dose to diminish, but sometimes the daughters of the parent may be as dangerous or more dangerous than the original. Also, there is organic contaminants may be present, and they may affect, obviously, what goes on in the smear zone. They occur as ganglia or blobs, and they have an effect on complexing the uranium. And then the best example, which I just showed earlier, is uranium at the Hanford 300 area along the Columbia River. And this is affected by seasonal or daily fluctuations in the water table. So therefore, the smear zone is a zone of highly transient behavior, both from the standpoint of groundwater flow conditions, but more importantly, geochemistry, and we think microbial. And we are interested in understanding more about that, particularly with regard to modeling and monitoring, and we use what are called performance indicators to say how well is the system behaving, is there stability both in the short term, and is there a probability that over the long term it will also be stable. We want to create, or the licensee wants to create, a reducing environment over the long term, and we think that the uranium may or may not be mobile depending upon how well you maintain those reducing conditions. This is pretty much what I've just said. One of the most important things is the oxygen content. Groundwater, obviously, the infiltration, percolation, and recharge brings oxygen into the system, and that affects the four radionuclides I mentioned earlier. Also, the volatilization of tritium and carbon-14 due to thermal and atmospheric changes, and that can be depending upon how close the smear zone is to the land surface. From a geochemical and hydrologic, and I should add microbial, monitoring needs, we want to have both temporal and spatial scale dependency with regard to when and where the smearing occurs. This is an example, obviously, again from the Hanford site of tanks. And the question here is, what kind of information do you need when you do a type of remediation? The tanks obviously could leak and cause perch water systems. There's other engineered systems that may cause leaks. You have perch systems. Obviously, these are highly transient. The wells themselves for monitoring may become avenues, inadvertent avenue pathways. And then, of course, the radionuclides move through the saturated zone. We're interested, obviously, in the zone of fluctuation of the water table and in these perch water systems. One of the issues because of the long-term constraints is what are the uncertainties? How do you develop a conception model? Yesterday, Yakov did a wonderful job talking about model abstraction. How do you take something this complex and turn it into something relatively understandable that you can actually model and monitor and have a high confidence that, yes, in fact, the remediation that you chose will work over the long term? So the first question we ask ourselves is, how do you characterize the smear zone? You can do it obviously by groundwater flow fluctuations, but more importantly, what are the transients involved because of the two-phase aspect? What would be the appropriate performance indicators to monitor, and how do you monitor those? I'll say this somewhat parenthetically, but at our licensed facilities, contractors and licensees are very loath to do unsaturated zone monitoring. They feel much more comfortable monitoring in the saturated zone, but obviously in this case where the smear zone's involved, you have to look at the transient conditions at different times and spatial scales. Often monitoring is on a quarterly basis every 3 months. Obviously that is not going to capture the transient nature of the microbial, geochemical, and hydrologic processes. And then finally, how do you model the mobility of radionuclides in the smear zone? And Fred and others have given us some ideas in the past, and Reen, on how mobile are certain solute constituents. A lot of the talk, of my talk, deals with the geochemistry of the smear zone, and we want to know something about the behavior of the precipitated minerals, whether they form coatings or not, and how those orthogenic minerals, do they differ from the unsaturated to the saturated zone? And what are the microbial communities? There are many competing communities Phil Jardine and the people at Oak Ridge, and Steve Yabusaki and Phil Long are doing work for DOE, and they're discovering there are hundreds of microbial communities. All of them behave differently. Some will develop a supremacy over others. And so the idea is, how do you stimulate the microbes that you want, iron reducing or sulfate reducing microbes? And then the question is, if reoxidation is to occur, how quickly can it occur? In the case we're looking at a licensed facility, the question there is groundwater recharge due to intense precipitation or flooding of a nearby river, and how can that introduce oxygen to the system? And so it's the dynamic between surface and groundwater in the smear zone that we're hoping to model. I've already mentioned the solubility issue, the distribution of electron donors and acceptors. What basically you're doing is you would be putting a electron donor, it could be acetate, alcohol, whatever, into the unsaturated zone and hoping to stimulate the microbial communities such as Geobacter, and then that would reduce both the iron and the uranium, and is they would be the acceptors, and it would become much more stable and immobile. Finally, the question is what about water content and groundwater recharge? Do they correlate with radionuclide behavior? And so there's opportunities here for monitoring on small scale over relatively short time periods. There's a range of remediation activities. Most of you know about pump and treat, and monitor natural attenuation, which EPA is pushing pretty hard. We've tried this, as I said earlier, at some sites. It doesn't always work, and so therefore some people are proposing bioremediation in which you use natural gradient or groundwater sweep or force gradient. Force gradients, and or if you want to do it without the use of microbes, you can do it abiotically using geochemical walls, and this is an example of some DOE facilities. And then finally, excavation removal. There's a variety of strategies for that. If you notice, the cost goes up dramatically going from the monitor natural attenuation to the excavation. Most people would prefer excavation removal, putting a slurry wall around, dewatering it, and literally removing it. Other people, because of cost, want to go with in-situ bioremediation. And the increasing technical uncertainty obviously is driven in that direction. I've mentioned already what bioremediation is. It's to generate a chemically reducing condition to precipitate the uranium, going from uranium 6 state to 4. 4 is relatively immobile. It isn't totally immobile, but it's relatively immobile compared to uranium 6. And the same for iron. Now, iron is important because iron will be how the system, when oxygen does come in, theoretically will go after the iron first and then the uranium. So to some extent, the iron serves as a banking, a buffering, when you have transient oxidation or redox conditions developing. Let's see, I'm running out of time, so let me just quickly run through. I've already mentioned this and the donor and acceptors. This is an example. This is a view of the old rifle site in Colorado, a work being done by P&L, Steve Yabusaki, and Phil Long, in which they are injecting in these stainless steel injector wells, small wells, acetate, and then as the acetate moves through the system, then theoretically the uranium is becoming immobile, and then they use a flow cell using slow purge sampling to measure what we call performance indicators, pH, EH, dissolved oxygen, temperature, and conductivity. We think that they're an excellent indicator, as well as the uranium itself and iron. And this is the list I just mentioned. One of the things that most people are very loath to do is to worry about microbial species and their behavior. They only want to look at the products. So here's an opportunity. You mentioned earlier how soil scientists could become involved. The scale and the issue of monitoring and modeling is going to be a really important factor in determining the efficacy of this remediation approach. What studies do we have going? Well, yesterday, Yakov talked about the work he's doing at Beltsville on preferential flow paths and understanding movement through soils to the water table and onto a first-order riparian stream. PNL, as I mentioned before, has been doing quite a bit of work at the Hanford 300, John Zacher and those people. The USGS, Jim Davis and others are looking at what are called surface complexation models, how clay and phyllosilicate structures can absorb uranium and other radionuclides. And work has been going on at the Naderita site in Colorado on the banks of San Miguel River, a former mill tailing site. Gary Curtis and those people are doing that work, and we're using that field data. And then finally, there is a series of studies that we just started to fund to look at the modeling and monitoring, but primarily the modeling of uranium. And if you have any interest in further information on this, we have a series of reports that you might want to get a hold of. If you go to our website, http://www.nrc.gov, these reports, the ones I listed before, are available, and you can read all about it. So that's all I have. Thank you very much for your patience.
One question?